We are happy to welcome to the show a prolific author who's had a number of best-selling books. He's released three new books just this year. His latest is called Long Shadows. We're talking, of course, about David Baldacci, who joins us this afternoon on Downtown. Well, hello there, David. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
I have to ask you an important question up front here, because our town, Bangor, Maine, we have a ton of Baldaccis, including our former governor. Now, they claim to be related to you. Do you admit to that? Do you claim them?
Yes, I do. Yeah, I know John. I've known John for a long time. He's a great guy. He's a great congressman and a great governor. And I like to say that there are a lot of Balducci's, but there aren't that many Baldaccis. So I think we're all related in some way. And John's a good friend, and his family, a wonderful family.
Absolutely. I grew up with the Baldacci family. Well, it's great to have you with us today. The new book is so good, Long Shadows. Man, what an opening to the book. You pulled me in pretty quickly there.
Yeah, I did. I really like to hit the ground running with my novels, and this is a way to sort of set up Decker for what was going to keep coming at him in waves in this novel, and that was change. So in the opening chapters, he suffers a really traumatic experience involving somebody very close to him. And then on top of that, receives news that he has a brand new partner that he doesn't want. Her name is Freddie White. She's from the Baltimore office. And then as they're butting heads and not getting along, they find out they have to fly to South Florida because a federal judge and her bodyguard have been found murdered in the judge's home. And they have to fly down and try to figure this out. And this is the only time I've written about Amos Decker where he's not really sure he wants to take another case on. He's not sure he wants to do this anymore. So he's not on his A game from the get-go. And so things have to happen in this book, and they do, that really shake him up. And I really enjoy creating Freddie's character. She's a spitfire. She's a dynamo. She goes toe-to-toe with this huge guy, and she gives as good as she gets.
Yeah, and it seems like bringing Freddie in gives you a chance to explore some new aspects of Amos's character.
Really does, because she pushes and pushes and pushes and makes him think about things that maybe he doesn't want to think about. And also, I love Freddie for the fact that she allowed me to use a classic line for one of my favorite movies of all time. And I finally got to use it. I've been waiting 20 years. And she delivers it, and it's just a hell of a scene.
So Amos is such a popular character, but what do you like about him?
What I like about Decker is he's totally unpredictable. Even though I created him and I read all the scenes and I read all his dialogue and his all interior monologue, sometimes I don't know what the guy's going to do, you know? And that for me is a cool thing as a writer, because it keeps me on my toes, and I don't have everything figured out, and everything is neat and nice and organized and tied with a bow, which you don't really want when you're writing a mystery and a thriller. You want things to be unexpected. So he's the guy who throws curveballs at me. I've written a line of dialogue for the guy, and then it's like he slapped me upside the head. It said, are you kidding me? I never would have said that. And, I go and I delete it and I write something else, and he looks at me and goes, okay, we can move on. That's okay.
Well, when you know a character that well, when you find that voice, do the characters often lead you to unexpected places?
They absolutely do. I mean, in this book, in particular, for sure, because he's dealing with a bunch of stuff that he doesn't want to deal with right now. And the biggest thing is that he seems like he's lost his drive. The one thing that drives Amos Decker more than anything else is if somebody does something bad, they need to be held accountable, and he's the one that's going to do it. And he's never wavered from that. That's his mantra in the preceding six books. In this one, he's not sure he wants to do this anymore. He's not sure he's up for it. He's not sure that the belly fire is still there. And then for me, as I'm writing this novel, I'm wondering, is the big guy going to get the belly fire back? I'm not sure at this point. Where is he going to take me? And at the end of the day, it all sort of worked out.
Decker, of course, has the gift and the curse of perfect recall. Is that something you would ever want?
No, I mean, I have a pretty good memory. I don't have a photographic memory for the most part. Some things, yes, but most things, no. But no, because most of us have things we'd rather forget, or we'd rather let time fade. And for him, time doesn't fade anything. So bad things that happened to him 20 years ago feel like they just happened to him. So I would imagine that is a heavy burden to bear.
We're talking with David Baldacci here on Downtown. How do you know when you've reached the end of the line, when a character has run their course?
When you sit down and thinking about a new story for them, and there's no fresh meat left on the bone. There's no juice left in the lemon to squeeze out. You got everything, the person, they had no more to give you. Then I think that's when it's time, you know, to retire them and move on to something else. Because the last thing you want to do is go in a lackluster manner into writing another book with not a lot of fresh stuff, no way to evolve the character, no new stuff to show of the character, and just put them into another plot, another case to solve. Because then it'll start reading like all the other books. And you don't want that. You're not going to be as energetic, not as enthusiastic. Your belly fire as the writer and creator is not going to be there. So you're not going to be writing from your A game. And it's just, you know, do I have more questions about the character? Does the character have more to give me and the readers? And if I scratch under the surface, is it going to be more meat under there? And if not, then it's time to move on.
You know, Stephen King owns our radio station, and much like Steve, you have been so incredibly productive and prolific lately. What's the key to that for you? Do you have a daily writing schedule?
I think the key for me is I've never looked at writing as a job. I wrote for years and never made a penny off of it. I just wrote for the love of writing because storytelling was such an intimate part of my life. And I haven't changed that perspective over the years. I don't look at it as I turn in a book and I get a paycheck. I sit down and I write because I just want to write. That's how I want to spend my time. So because of that love and that drive, I spend a lot of time writing. You know, I've written 3 books this year. This is the 3rd one. It's not because I had a preset schedule or a contract to do it. It's because I had 3 ideas for 3 different stories and off I went and wrote them that I was very excited about. So really, it's just how I approach, you know, the craft of writing. Never a job, not a hobby, not even a passion. It's more like this is who I identify as. You know, I can't separate me from the writer. It's just we're all in one little ball.
David, can you talk a little bit about the work you do through the Wish You Well Foundation?
Yeah, my wife and I started it over 20 years ago. We fund literacy organizations, programs, and efforts across the country. Our job is to eradicate illiteracy in the United States. That's our mission. We have a huge illiteracy problem where, you know, half the adult population read at the 2 lowest levels of literacy. And when you have generational illiteracy, which I like to call it, you also have generational poverty. Illiteracy and poverty go hand in hand. If you can't read at a high level, chances are very high that you're going to be non-self-sustaining, that you're going to be, you know, on government programs that will help you through difficult times. Our job is to make people, give them the tools to reach their full potential. And as an aside, you know, not even from the economic benefits, being a reader will make you a better person, more tolerant, more empathetic, more understanding, more well-rounded, have a broader horizon on humankind than people who don't read. You know, Mark Twain, there's a famous quote that he wrote, that he came up with, and said, travel is fatal to prejudice. He was the most traveled man of the generation, traveled the world. But for those of you who don't have time to travel, you can travel the world through books, and you can see lots of different people who don't look like you, read like you, pray like you, eat like you, speak like you. But you'll understand that we all share the common core of humanity. And that's a perspective I had since I was a little kid when the world of books was introduced to me. And I want to make sure that every person in this country has that same opportunity.
Well, is it a stretch at all to say that literacy also helps protect the democracy?
You can't have one without the other. If you don't have an informed electorate making good decisions based on fact and truth, then you don't have a democracy. And that's just the way it's going to be. And we live in an information age, and we live in a disinformation age, the likes of which we have never seen before. And so for people who have nothing, no context with which to evaluate all this stuff flying at them, they can believe things that aren't true. They can go to rabbit holes they shouldn't be going down. People talk about, you know, you want to eat superfoods for your diet to make sure you're physically healthy. I would say that books are superfood for your mind and your soul. And you can have superfoods to make you physically healthy. If you're not reading books to make you emotionally and mentally healthy, then you're going to curl up and die emotionally and mentally without that type of superfood, without that substance. And it's really the only thing that keeps our democracy alive.
And along those same lines, your Feeding Body and Mind initiative donates books to food banks around the country. And I think that's great because I feel that those who are most at risk are often left out when it comes to access to reading and books as well.
They absolutely are. You know, in this country, school systems and the funding they get are based on where those schools are. It's local funding. In other countries, you know, you have a certain amount of money set aside for education, and in the different places get the same amount. So if you live in a rich area, your schools have a lot of money. If you live in a poor area, your schools don't have a lot of money. And that makes for a disparity in inequality and inequities that are detrimental to all of us, because those breed, you know, you can tie illiteracy to pretty much all the societal problems we have, everything from drugs to crime, incarceration, because when you take people out of the mainstream, because they don't have the ability to read, they don't have a good education, then you narrow the opportunities that they have and the choices they can make. So if you broaden those choices and make things far more equitable, all of our other problems really go away.
I'm a high school teacher, and the attacks that we see on books in education in America are certainly scary from our perspective. What's it like from the perspective of a writer?
It's totally beyond the pale. In 2022, I never thought that I'd be talking about book banning and book burning. And I'm a student of history, and people who read, you know, they have, again, they have context of which to evaluate this. There have been many instances through history of people rising up and saying, we need to ban books, we need to burn these books. None of them ever had a positive outcome. All of them actually had a cataclysmic outcome for humankind at various levels. So this playbook has been done before. This is nothing new. And I fear that the results that we're going to see are going to parallel what's happened in the past. Saying that books are bad for people, that books shouldn't be in libraries, my point is, in a library, people get to choose the books they want to read. And telling someone, you know, there's something bad in that book, don't read it. I'm wondering, are parents monitoring their kids' activities online? Because I can tell you for a fact that the stuff they can have readily access on online, there's nothing in a book that would compare to that stuff. So you can say, well, they can be exposed to one, but not the other. So for me, telling people, you know, not to read books, not to read certain books, is deprive them of the freedoms they have, you know, to pursue their own intellectual pursuits and their own choices. And that never ends well.
Absolutely. Well, David, it's wonderful to talk with you. Thank you for the good work you're doing. The new book, Long Shadows, absolutely terrific. More adventures with the memory man, Amos Decker. Thank you so much for making time for us today, David.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.